Thank you for standing by. This is the conference operator. Welcome to Aurania Resources Limited Update on Exploration conference call and webcast. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode, and the conference is being recorded. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To join the question queue, you may press star then one on your telephone keypad. Should you need assistance during the conference call, you may signal an operator by pressing star and zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Keith Barron, Chairman and CEO, and Dr. Richard Spencer, President. Please go ahead.
Great. Morning, everyone. Thanks very much for joining this call, which comes to you from Vancouver, from the sort of periphery of the Sprott conference. Our idea of having the presentation this morning was more or less this presentation was given yesterday between Keith had a presentation and I had as well. We just wanted to give everyone else the opportunity to hear more or less what we said at the conference yesterday. Do you want to add anything?
Just wanted to pass on that it was very, very well received, well attended yesterday, and some very, very good questions.
The slide presentation, obviously we will be making forward-looking statements. That's outlined on page two. On page three, just a reminder of where the land position is, a really big concession area that is on geological trend of Ecuador's growing mining area down to the south there. In the circles are two really important developments in Ecuador's mining history. The one is Fruta del Norte is very, very close to pouring its first gold. I believe that that's going to happen in September. In fact, the copper, and that was a deposit, obviously, that was discovered by Keith in his former company, Aurelian. The second really important thing that's happened in Ecuador over the last couple of weeks is the official opening of the Mirador open pit copper mine, Ecuador's first open pit. That was a discovery that my team made back in the mid-90s, also working for a former company. I don't think that there's any better way of demonstrating that Ecuador is open for business more than the fact that the two big mines have been permitted, have been and are going into full production very, very shortly. So the country is open for business. Flipping over onto page four, that's just an underground view of Fruta del Norte production scheduled for very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And
I might add that they are already mining in the ore zone. They're stockpiling on surface. The mill isn't quite ready yet, as I understand. I visited the project a couple months ago. There are 2,000 men running around in construction, and they're very, very close. It's wonderful to go back and see this wonderful development.
Mirador actually officially opened a couple of weeks ago, July the 19th. So that's a huge day for Ecuador. Page six, and I should just mention on this under the modern mining law, the government gets a royalty from production, and 3% of that royalty actually goes back to the surrounding communities. So the positive impact that the opening of this responsible mining is going to have on the local populace is certainly an effect that they haven't seen before. It's going to be transformational to those communities. On page six, I mean, management obviously has a deep history in Ecuador, and we've been blessed with a bit of success there. And on page seven, for those of you that weren't at the AGM a month ago, We have three new board members. The board has been significantly strengthened with the addition of Leanne Baker, Warren Gilman, and Jonathan Kagan to the board. Just a quick reminder on the capital structure. The bottom right pie chart says it all. 57% of the shares are held by management. Keith owns 53%. And there's no better way of saying that the company is aligned with the rest of the shareholders. There are also some other big blocks of shares out there that are tightly held by individuals and institutions. And, you know, that means that the public float is probably only in the order of about 25% or so of the total shares, which makes the stock relatively volatile. And I think that that can be seen as creating some good opportunities as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamental takeaway is that management led by Keith is absolutely fundamentally behind this company. And the capital structure is self-explanatory up in the top left. So on page 9, what have we done? Mm-hmm. I think on the left-hand side, for those of you who've followed our press releases, that's pretty evident. We've drilled the first of the epithermal targets. I'll go through those results a little bit later, and we're now moving on to drill the second and the third and the fourth epithermal targets that have been prioritized. And obviously, we're continuing with the stream sediment sampling. We've covered about half the area so far, half of the 208,000 hectares. And it's a relatively inexpensive way of giving us blanket coverage that gives us it's our principal way of defining the targets. Obviously, we've broken up the epithermal targets. We continue to focus on them, but we'll talk some more about this opportunity that's presented by the sediment-hosted copper. We hope to get a second rig onto the sedimentary copper later on in the year, and we'll also talk a little bit more about Metron's dealing with the big data in the company. So on page 10, I mean, this is really just for people that are new to the story, the whole historic background as to why the concession block was taken up. Based on the location of Sevilla and Logroño, the two historic Spanish mining areas, and the fact that the belt's on the geological extension of this very rich copper and gold belt down in the south. Flipping over onto page 11, you know, the inclusion in Metron of Metron in our exploration program is something relatively new for an exploration company. Metron certainly has never worked for an exploration or resource company before. And on page 11, I mean, on the left-hand side, we're just trying to illustrate that we have all these different sources of exploration data, and we sort of see them as layers that in the conventional way, the way I look at it or Keith looks at it or any exploration geologist, We sort of layer those layers one on top of each other and try and identify the targets from that. And in that, we're bringing in a whole lot of our own bias and our own experience and all that, which is critically important. But at the same time, there's a danger in doing that, and that one might be blinkered without actually realizing it, and one might not actually be quite as open to other targets as as open to the data as we should be. So the Metron data or the Metron data analysis is being done now that we're halfway through the stream sediment program. That's what sort of triggered that the deal with Metron. And they're going to be looking at exactly the same data, starting with the historic and then adding all these other data layers, the geophysics and everything on top of that. But they look at it in a completely unbiased way. They have a complex mathematical algorithm that just identifies which cell blocks are more likely to have the historic gold mines on them. But in addition to that, they would also identify areas of gold and copper and lead, zinc, and all the rest of it.
I might just add, Metron is very, very excited about this. And as Richard said, they've never done work for a resource company before. And this is an approach that, as we understand, has never, ever been used by the resource industry ever. Now, this came about, actually goes back a long way, when I was reading a book about Metron's involvement, headed up by Larry Stone, and they found the Ship of Gold off the coast of off the east coast of America, with more than $1 billion worth of gold on it, and that was lifted up off the sea bottom. The process works. The Metron company did go on to find the black boxes a couple of years ago from the Air France disaster, the Air France plane that went down in the Atlantic. But what we thought was that rather than have all of our historical stuff, of which you know, collectively we're talking about a foot and a half thickness of paper sitting on the shelf, why not integrate that into an algorithm and produce a probability map? And what a probability map is essentially, they're going to take our concessions, break them down into 500 by 500 meter blocks, and then put a number to each block of what the probability is of Sevilla de Oro or Logroño sitting in that block. That's one part of it. And then of course, the ones with the highest probability we go and tackle and look at first, and potentially they're going to be places we have not been before with our exploration teams. But also what they're going to do, remember, we're halfway through the stream sediment sampling. We've got almost 3,000 samples under our belt. That's a hell of a lot of data when we're basically doing half the periodic table for each sample. Combined with that, we've got soil geochemistry that we've done, we've got the geophysics and all the rest of it, and you can get lost in this data very easily. And we have seen companies do this before. If the listeners are familiar with the Navidad deposits down in Argentina, that was not found. It was a whopping great silver anomaly, but it was just buried in masses and masses and masses of overwhelming data. So the one thing that the Metron people are going to do is take that big data and on this very, very big land package and kind of distill it down into probability maps, not just for the lost cities, but also for ore deposits. And that is going to be a very, very interesting exercise.
And the timing on that is that we expect our first product from Metron, and obviously we're working on a daily basis with the Metron guys in a sub team. Mid-October we'll have our first probability map, and then as we tweak different components of the data and weight the data differently, and as we add new data, obviously we're going to have various iterations of that. But yeah, first product should be about mid-October. Whether we decide to talk about that at that time or not remains to be seen. Okay, so moving on to page 12, we obviously are a gold-focused company. Our targets are the two historic mines of Logroño and Sevilla, and the geochemistry and geophysics has defined as 17 targets, epithermal kind of targets for gold and silver from mainly the stream sediment data. However, you know, as we take the stream sediment samples, and as Keith mentioned, we analyze for almost half the periodic table, not quite about 40 elements. In paying for the gold and silver analysis, we automatically pay for the rest of the elements as well. So the stream sediment data tells us what other metals are enriched within the drainage basin represented by each sample. So, you know, copper and lead zinc will come out of that data. It's effectively free for us because we've already paid for it in our interest for the gold and silver. And out of that, there's the sediment-hosted copper silver that extends over about a 22-kilometer trend. The silver zinc lead about 15-kilometer trend, and we've got many porphyry targets, mainly identified by the geophysics. On page 13, just concentrating on the episomal targets, the gold-silver targets for a minute. So the scout drilling was completed on Crunchy Hill. We are planning to start drilling, on the right-hand side there on page 13, the white areas are the 50% of the concession area that have been covered. We haven't shown the concession outline for good reason. We don't want the other companies to know exactly where we are within the Cordillera. But, you know, Crunchy Hill's been drilled, and Yowie, there are four targets there, and it looks as though we're going to have the permitting done and everything for drilling to start there in September. And we will probably drill the four targets in Yowie and then move on to target number six in the south, and that's what the idea of those numbers is. That's today's ranking. But obviously, as new data comes in from new targets, so that ranking might change. Page 14. Crunchy Hill, I just wanted to put this in context a little bit because obviously the results were not good. We picked up a little bit of silver, no gold, but this doesn't scare me one little bit. I have been through this process in every single discovery that we've been privileged enough to make. Negative data doesn't scare me at all. What our drilling showed at Crunchy is the presence of two big veins, and they're illustrated on the right hand side by the vein that goes from blue through to orange and red. And at the top is gypsum, and then kaolinite and adularia. Those are different alteration minerals that we use to track where we are in the system. And, you know, normally there's a gap of about 200 meters between the very top of the system and where the gold system starts, so 150, 200 meters. What we found, and that's what we targeted at Crunchy, and that's why the drilling went to that depth. But what we found in the veins that we intersected was, first of all, that the veins weren't very well developed and they looked as though they were high in the system. And the alteration minerals, which are the minerals that develop in the walls of the veins from the interaction of the hot fluid that's bringing in the minerals with the surrounding cool rock, that hot fluid leaves a fingerprint on those rocks by developing these so-called alteration minerals, and adularian, kaolinite, and gypsum are those minerals. And the vector that we got out of our drill intercepts was all saying, go deeper. Why that is, we honestly don't know at this stage, but, you know, I'm actually relatively excited about Crunchy because we drilled. We didn't get what we want, but out of it in terms of grade, but out of that, we know where to go with that drilling. Why didn't we carry on drilling at Crunchy? Well, we can sit there and blow our brains out drilling one target while there are other targets that might be simpler, the gold might be shallow or whatever. So it is our duty to maintain the discipline of once we've identified the stack at the moment we've got 17 epithermal targets, we have got to keep drilling those ones. There might be one that is simpler, shallow, or whatever it is, and that might be the one to focus on. And we might come back and drill Crunchy in the future or any other target in the future. So that's what our concept is there. Flipping on to page 15. This is the drill planning in Yowie. We've taken our understanding from Crunchy to say, okay, for whatever reason in this area, there seems to be a bigger gap between the old land surface and where the gold is. So we've modified our drill plan to drill a little bit deeper, using the steep topography in that area to drill the system deeper. That's what the plan is for the drilling that starts in September. Page 16. The graphic in the middle there is an image of the, it's a postage stamp of the geophysics, and the purple and pink colors are the very magnetic rocks that would be typically the typical signature of a porphyry, which is basically a granitic cylinder that comes up into the crust, and very often that contains copper mineralization. So when we say, when our field geologists went into the field to look at those geophysical hotspots, those hot colors, we expected to find copper, but we expected the grade of that copper to fade off as we got further and further from the red areas, and we didn't find that at all. The copper grades maintained. The copper is very high grade. The average is around about 4%. And critically, there's almost 2 ounces of silver as an average grade in those samples. And we began to realize that we were looking at a layer of copper silver that was relatively flat, that went over the top of the porphyries. The grades were not related directly to those geophysical targets. And we've tried to illustrate this on page 17. The exploration concept, that's a vertical slice, and the porphyry would be that sort of carrot-shaped thing at depth there. And they typically would have formed originally under a volcano, which has now been eroded off. But, you know, we expected to see the copper concentrated around the porphyry, and we absolutely didn't find that. Instead, we found the copper in one specific layer, and between the so-called red beds and the reducing beds. And the exciting thing about this is that not only does the copper outcrop, you know, the fact that we are the first people doing modern exploration in this area means that we were the first people to stumble across these bright green rocks that no geologist on the planet could possibly walk over without recognizing. The fact that we were first in this area gave us the opportunity of coming up with this copper discovery. What we've got to do now is join those various samples that we've got in 18 different locations strung out along those 22 kilometers. Remember that this is very deep and dense jungle, and we've got to start in the field tracing those copper exposures out along trend and starting to demonstrate continuity there. And then once we've demonstrated that continuity through the field work, we would then come in and start drilling, and we would hope to do that in the last quarter of the year. On page 18, this is using an example of the kind of deposit that we're looking for in this sediment-hosted copper. A very good analog is the Kakula deposit, which Ivanhoe has in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And that is the main graphic is a vertical slice through that deposit. The little red histograms are the copper grades. And you'll notice that the copper lies at the contact or the interface between the sedimentary rocks that are shown in blue and the sedimentary rocks shown in white. But the takeaway is that these tend to be relatively flat sheets. They are relatively predictable. They're relatively simple to drill out. And, you know, they are typically very big deposits. So we believe that this deposit type that we didn't expect to find in the area is potentially a real value driver for the company.
I want to add here, this is extremely exciting for me because of the silver grades, and we're finding silver in every sample. across the 22 kilometers. Now, we haven't found the ends of this thing yet, so we really don't know how big it is. But 2 points comparing it to the stuff that is presented here from Ivanhoe's Kakula deposit. Ivanhoe, you know, we're looking at the sections here, and it's like a good 800, 900, 1,000 meters down. Our stuff is at surface, the stuff that we found so far at surface, and that has got a very, very big difference in terms of the economics for potentially mining it down the road. The other thing is that all of our stuff is oxide copper. It is not sulfide copper like the stuff in the Congo. Now, what we're finding is the sort of thing that was found in the Congo, but in the 1890s, 1900, 1910, when Leopold II owned what was called then the Belgian Congo, and it went across the border into what is now Zambia, but used to be called Northern Rhodesia. All that stuff at surface, all of that oxide is gone. It's been stripped off. It was mined decades and decades and decades ago. And my contention is that if somebody was to have walked over, remember, we're working in a virgin area. If someone was to walk over our area back 30, 40 years ago and found these beautiful green rocks on surface, this stuff would be gone too. It would have been long since mined. It's very, very easy to process. Another thing that's very interesting is that this type of copper, because oxide is amenable to very simple extraction, SXEW, solvent extraction, electrowinning process, and already on the drawing board, there is a hydroelectric dam of 3.5 gigawatts, 50 kilometers away from this, only 50 kilometers away, that has already gone through the environmental process with the governments. Governments looking for funding to build the hydroelectric project. But this is an incredible opportunity because a lot of the major components are here already.
Keith, just to clarify, the right-hand numbers on the vertical slice through Kakula are elevation above sea level, so the deposit is a couple of hundred meters down. Ours is better because it's in outcrop.
Well, down to like 700 meters, but certainly starting at around 400 meters down.
Correct.
Way below the zone of oxidation. So all this stuff is very sulfide rich and would need a smelter.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so on page 19, you know, I mentioned earlier that on the earlier reference to the graphic on the left is that the copper grades just go over the porphyry targets. They don't seem to pay any attention to them at all. However, those red blobs, the purple blobs on the geophysics are still viable porphyry targets, and there's not to say that we have porphyries beneath these the layer of copper silver in the sediment. So those
are
still viable targets.
They're not only are they viable targets, everywhere in the southern part of the belt, down in the Condor, and I know because I drilled some of them on the Aurelian property. You drill the magnetic highs where the accumulation of magnetite is in the rock, and we hit copper. And, you know, there's no getting away from this. These are very, very, very strong and prominent magnetic targets. And what they mean is that in the subsurface, there is a accumulation of magnetite, which is an iron-rich mineral, and typically, this would occur with copper. So I'm quite confident that these things are porphyries and that they're going to be copper bearing, but I cannot tell you what grades are going to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And just nipping over onto page 20, you know, we also have this silver, lead, zinc mineralization defined by the stream sediment sampling over a 15 kilometer trend. Now, you know, if we didn't have any other targets, we would certainly be talking about that. It's relatively low ranked in our priorities at the moment, but there are a lot of base metal companies out there that are looking exactly for this kind of deposit. So it's something that we could potentially do a joint venture on and create a bit of shareholder value that way. Okay, on page 21, operational next steps. We've mentioned them through the presentation. Complete the stream sediment sampling. Continue the scout drilling of the epithermal targets, starting with the first of the four targets at Yowie in September. The sediment-hosted copper-silver is an absolute gift in that it's there. We didn't expect it to be there. It is simple geometrically, and we would like to start drilling that in November. And we've talked about the Metron work, which is really exciting. It's basically creating a safety net to make sure that through our experience, which is so important, that we're not being negatively impacted by that in having blinkers on, which we don't realize. And, you know, we will start talking to the bigger companies about joint ventures as well. Page 22, I think, is a critically important graphic because, you know, it's fine to talk about joint ventures in general terms, but these are examples of the joint ventures that have already been signed in Ecuador. You know, it's really important to show that the big companies are throwing enormous amounts of money around that are appropriate to really developing these targets and advancing them quickly. But we should also underline that the first one, the Anglo-American Luminex deal, for example, covers 64,000 hectares. Remember that our concession block is three times that at 208,000 hectares. BHP Luminex is spending $82 million in the ground for 70%. In other words, the Luminex shareholders, after all of that expenditure, maintain a 30% carried interest in the project. So it's, you know, these guys are serious about joint ventures. Note that three of those joint ventures are very much copper orientated. The only one that is, in fact, four of them are, but the Newcrest Cornerstone one has a gold component to it. So very much a copper emphasis by the big companies in Ecuador. And, you know, just in summary on page 23, Ecuador is demonstrating that it's open for business. We have this incredibly prospective, continuous, big block of concessions. The management has done this before. The board has been augmented. And, you know, our strategy is absolutely clear. We are gold-focused, but at the same time, we would be stupid if we didn't look at the base metal opportunities that are coming up from our data at effectively no extra cost to us. And, you know, what we really like, as Keith mentioned, about the continuity of the copper silver is the silver content of it. That adds a potential byproduct in the future. And even the lead zinc potentially quite a value driver there, but in joint ventures. And, you know, we obviously are in the middle of a financing private placement. Unfortunately, we're doing it at a share price that's not as strong as it has been over the last couple of months. However, you know, there are two ways of looking at that. The one is to see this as a great entry point and opportunity. So the units are priced at $2.70 Canadian. We're raising $4 million with potential to go to $5 million Canadian, and with the share that you get in the unit, there's a half warrant that's valid for 18 months, and that's priced at $4. We think that $4 is certainly achievable with the exploration results that we expect to have over the next couple of months. Page 25, obviously we continue to work with the communities in a very big way. And that's it from our side. Carl, do you want to open it up for questions.
Certainly, sir. We will now begin the question and answer session. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing any keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. We will pause for a moment as callers join the queue. The first question comes from Mark Reichman of Noble Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I had three questions, and I may just ask one or two and hop back in the queue to allow others to ask questions. But the first is, could you elaborate on the process that's taking place to enable Metron to conduct their analysis, kind of the overall time frame and the outputs you expect with respect to narrowing in on the two lost cities versus a broader framework of helping you to either rule in or rule out concessions currently held? And given that you've pretty much conducted geophysical surveys on most of the property, but are halfway through the stream sediment sampling, for those areas where no stream sampling has been conducted, do you think there's enough data absent those stream samples to draw a high confidence conclusion?
Carl, let me start with the second part of your question. You're sort of asking as to how Metron is going to help us prioritize the targets. We've never published the geophysics for very good reason. There are trends in the geophysics that would help our competitors in the area. And, all I can say about the geophysics without showing it is that it's a little overwhelming. We have a large number of targets there that looking at the targets and trying to rank them on their geophysical features sort of alone, it's just an overwhelming prospect. So, obviously we are overlaying the geological data on that and prioritizing the targets that way. But what we're excited about with Metron is that they effectively come to the same place in their output, but they just do it in a completely different and unbiased way. And their output to us will be a map of the whole concession area, which, as Keith said, will be divided up into little cells that are 500 by 500 meters in size. And each of those cells, through the combination of all of this data, will be assigned a number that will be colored. And, we'll end up with a map with hot spots on it, red colors or whatever, for the areas that the mathematical algorithm has kicked out. And, we'll look at that map, I suspect, and the first one will be out in mid-October. And I would suspect that, we'll look at that map and be able to identify some of the red spots in it and say, that correlates with, our target that was generated from the geophysics or whatever. But I'm pretty sure that there are going to be spots of interest that have been identified by Metron's algorithm that we wouldn't have identified in our way of dealing with the data. So, in terms of timeline, mid-October, we should see the first map. How precise that map is going to be, no idea at this stage. And the other thing that I should just mention is that they're not only looking at the area that's been covered, the 50% that's been covered by the stream sets, they will be looking at the whole area. So they will be sort of forward-looking in the areas where we haven't had people in the field yet. So there will be targets in areas that we haven't been to. And, quite honestly, in terms of where Logroño and Sevilla are, I think that had they been in the 50% of the area that we covered, we would have seen them. The stream sediment sampling would have identified the spoil heaps that were left behind by the Spanish. So we're pretty sure that they lie within the area, the other 50% of the area, and I'm sure that Metron is going to have hotspots over those areas that we haven't been into.
Okay, and then on pages 9 and 21 of the presentation and the going forward plan of action, could you just maybe elaborate on the IP geophysics works leading up to scout drilling of Yowie and then those subsequent epithermal targets and then plans for bringing in a second drill for the other copper targets and, you know, the time frames, including completion for those drilling programs? And you may not be able to answer some of that because I realize it's
wow, that's a lot. Sometimes
yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think that first of all, talking about the IP, you know, we've had a little bit of a delay on getting that equipment into the country, so it's unlikely to be there before you know, mid August or so, mid or third week of August, which, you know, sort of crunches it up against the planned drilling at Yowie. You know, Mark, the geophysics, it is such an incredibly powerful tool if used correctly. You know, the problem with geophysics is that it's always going to generate a target, whether that target is real or not. It's just the nature of the methods. And, you know, so I am certainly not religious about doing geophysics before starting the drilling. I think that it's going to make sense time-wise to do them in parallel. And, you know, quite honestly, the more information, it's like anything, the more good information that you have going in, the better the conclusions or the more accurate the conclusions that you can draw from that. So, you know, if we happen to drill the first hole at Yowie, the data that we get from that first hole and the observations would be tied in with our interpretation of the geophysics, which the IP, which could be done the next week or simultaneously with the drilling. So, you know, I'm very wary of using sort of geophysics on its own, in inverted commas. You know, if we've got drilling that's going on at the same time to help us interpret the geophysics, I think we'll end up with a more powerful targeting tool at the end of that. So four targets at Yowie. We've got this new target down in the south. So I think we numbered it number six, on which there was the press release this morning. You know, Yowie and that new area in the south, both of them are relatively close to the paved roads, so the logistics are relatively easy. We're not talking about helicopters or anything. And, you know, we might work back and forth between the four targets at Yowie and the one up high in the south. You know, then on the water permits, it looks as though they're going to be through very, very soon. And if we don't get the water permits, we've got a backup plan for that anyway. And then, you know, we on the copper silver, we need field work to demonstrate continuity around the outcrops that we've already got. And then subsequent to that, once we've demonstrated that continuity, we would try and bring in, the plan is to bring in a rig to be focused on that target.
Well, thank you very much. I'll hop back in the queue.
Thanks, Mark.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one now. The next question comes from Robert Kasnabish of Wings for the World. Please go ahead.
Hey, congratulations. What a wonderful news about Metron. Although you have mentioned earlier, but now in detail about this, how the procedure will take place. This is just marvelous. I guess Keith and Richard doesn't waste any moment to implement newest of the new technology into the field. I was talking to Richard the other day that how lucky Metron would be to be able to work in a you know, mining industry. Aurania is going to be creating a milestone by introducing Metron into the field. Okay, my next question is, my question is, when are you bringing the second drill on the property?
And that is a very good question, a very direct question. And the simple answer to that is we're aiming at November. We're actually looking at alternative drill technology. The crucial thing is to be able to move the rig around the drill rig relatively easily. If it's man portable, it's better. The kind of rigs that do not need water for drilling, which is something that we're certainly looking at for the copper drilling, they tend to be much bigger rigs that would require a helicopter to move them around. We're looking at two different sort of drilling technologies for the copper. But the target for that, Bob, is November.
Great. Well, good luck with the shows, and I'm really excited, and my group is excited. So hopefully it is going to be a wonderful year.
Thanks.
Thank
and,
you.
You know, the other thing that I should just say about Metron, Metron, as Keith has mentioned, is really excited about this. It's a new field for them. I don't think they know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
We had our kickoff meeting with our technical team, with their technical team, on the 16th, a couple of weeks ago, and they were a little bit sort of boggled-eyed by the amount of data that there was and all that, but they're really excited about it. But, you know, the thing that I am so excited about is that it effectively, their approach creates a safety net for us because, you know, experience is a two-edged sword. It is fundamental to making new discoveries, but at the same time, you know, one can introduce bias through that good experience that is too strong, and you know, it can sort of blind us to other possibilities. And you know, I see Metron as, you know, obviously something extra that creates a safety net if our exploration teams have missed something. So it helps me to sleep better at night.
Right, and as Keith was mentioning, the amount of data that you have in your office, who knows that in humans, with all your supporting evidence and the data, they probably will be able to develop another new way of addressing the issue and working on the field, you know, because the data are the key factor over here, and it is all sitting and ready. So they have a great thing, you know, putting it and put onto their in the platter and given to them. So
if you just think of the stream sediment work, we've got about 3,000 samples now, and you know, 30 elements per sample. That's 90,000 pieces of data.
In fact, it's 41 elements.
41, it's even more. So it's over 100,000. And how can anybody keep that straight in their heads, right? So, this is why we're doing this exercise. Remember, we're only halfway there, so it's going to end up being 200,000.
Great, wonderful, great show. I'm looking forward to meet you guys in the office.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
The next question comes from Mark Reichman of Noble Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a couple of follow-ups. First, with respect to Metron, you'd mentioned that you'd received the first probability maps, I believe.
Oh, no, not yet. No. No, we're a long way from that.
Okay. Well, okay, I thought I had written down that you thought you might start getting some outputs in October. So the question is I guess really the question behind that is how long is this process, and do you think you'd be far enough along, you know, to when it's time to renew concessions in I guess next March, do you think you'd have enough data to be in a position to start dropping concessions?
Mark,
in that regard, it would almost pay for itself.
Yeah, Mark, sorry, just to clarify, yes, we are expecting the first report back from Metron in mid-October. That's what their timeline is. And, you know, they've already actually made quite a lot of progress How useful that first cut is going to be, obviously we have no idea because this is all absolutely new to us. It's new to them. So that is correct. We should have the first product in mid-October. The contract with Metron extends the work over 18 months if required. It really just depends, how quickly it defines things. They might suggest that we do additional work. One of the possibilities that's there are other technologies that could help. Depending on how strong the motivation is, we might consider introducing some of those other technologies, acquiring additional data. I've forgotten what the second part of your
question. Well, just with respect, do you think you'd be far enough along with that to start making decisions, when it's time to renew concessions? Do you think you'd be in a position to start ruling certain concessions out? So you don't have to, pay the concession fees for areas that.
Right.
You can't rule out.
Mark, I'm not sure on the basis of the Metron data, but certainly taking our conventional exploration approach, yes, we're very actively trying to identify areas that don't have much potential on them. I think it would go a long way for us for a number of reasons to start dropping concessions. The other thing to remind everyone is that we don't have to drop complete concessions. We can drop bits and pieces of different concessions. So if we have a target sitting on the common corner between four concessions, which is probably what's going to happen, Sod's Law, we can drop the parts that we don't want of those four concessions and keep effectively a new concession or four smaller concessions that cover the target area. Whether we're going to be able to do that by March, I don't know, but it's certainly top priority. We are absolutely focused on that to try and bring our concession fees
narrow it down a little bit, and to narrow the target areas down. I guess the other question was, and I really appreciated the slide on page 22 with respect to the joint ventures, but with respect to joint venturing the copper porphyry projects, at what point do you decide that these properties are ready to JV, and what does that look like?
Mark, I think that, 6 months ago, we would have said, and I think I did say, that around mid-year 2019, in other words now, I would have expected to have advanced discussions on joint ventures. I think the curveball, which is a very good curveball, is the arrival or the recognition of the copper silver, which is a relatively simple target. Because a joint venture generally is defined by a specific piece of land that's outlined by coordinates, it's a postage stamp of the whole of the rest of the concession area. Because 6 months ago, before we knew about the flat-lying copper-silver, we would have said, okay, there's a red blob on the geophysics, let's put a square around that and offer that to major company X. Today we're dealing with a situation where we're recognizing that if we had done that, we would have given away a block of the flat-lying sediment-hosted copper-silver as well. So we internally are sort of rejigging our thinking about that, and we're going to have to be a little bit creative. I think the big companies are open to being pretty creative as well. The copper companies don't want epithermal targets on their properties. And quite often we have an epithermal target that's close to a porphyry target. So, I think at the end of the day, we're going to end up with multiple JVs that are going to have very specific land positions associated with them.
Well, marvelous progress, and really appreciate this call. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one now. The next question comes from James Bryson, a private investor. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having the call. Two quick questions. How many holes did you get into Crunchy Hill before you can realize where you are in the system and that you're not close to the boiling zone, which is what you were hoping to be? Is it not worth sinking one deeper hole, or do you just take that approach and refine it at the next target, Yowie? And then my second question would be simply, is it cost prohibitive to do a LIDAR survey, which I would think might be the best bet of immediately showing the Spanish colonial dump sites? Thank you.
James, let me handle the crunchy one, and then
okay.
You can handle the LIDAR one.
I'll handle
one.
The second. Yeah.
James, outstanding questions. Your first one on Crunchy Hill, could we have stopped earlier? Absolutely. There are people out there who say, we showed a lack of indiscipline. We showed indiscipline because, we ended up drilling 9 holes when people had asked me in general terms, how many holes were you going to drill? And I said, well, a handful, 5. And we ended up drilling almost 9 of that. In hindsight, when you've got all the data, you can look at the holes and say, okay, well, maybe we could have saved a hole there. When you're on site, you don't have the data, you don't have the alteration data of these minerals that are developed from in response to the temperature of the fluid that the vein is seeing. There's a time lag on that. You've got to move that rig from one spot to the next. This always happens, and I must actually settle down. When we made the Kimsacocha discovery, I heard an individual who didn't know that I was involved in it say, these guys drilled in 4 directions from 1 drill pad. They had no concept of what they were doing. And at that point, now this guy was sitting in a soft sofa in the middle of Toronto somewhere, at that point, he was absolutely right. We did not know what was going on. So we stood in one place and we drilled in 4 directions. But that drilling it happened to hit the key fundamental issue or relationship that opened us up. And we from that drill site where we didn't know what was going on, that discovery stemmed from that point. So when people look at our data set and say, okay, well, you drilled 9 holes, maybe you should have stopped at 5. Quite honestly, I never expect to hear that comment from anyone who has ever made a true discovery. Sorry, I get a bit hot under the collar, but really. So hole number 9,
I was not commenting on the number of holes.
No. I'm not. I'm absolutely not saying that you are. I'm just venting because I've heard these comments from you. So sorry. No. I'm not casting any aspersions on you. And the question is absolutely outstanding, James. And I'm glad that you asked it. Holes 5 and 7. Taking all that away, holes 5 and 7 were fundamentally important. And hole 9 was fundamentally important because if we look at that cross section that we've published on Crunchy, without having drilled hole 9, we would have expected that the hot fluid system would have been confined to the Crunchy Hill itself below the hill there. Hole 9 has made us realize that actually we're dealing with a bigger system. And, your question about, should we not drill one more deeper hole? I can promise you that there is not one day that goes by without me wondering that same question. Huh. The, The advantage on Crunchy is that it is literally, and in fact where we would drill that hole, is literally within about 300 or 400 meters of the paved road. It's on the way back to civilization from Yowie. And, you know, potentially it would be relatively easy to pop an additional hole in there. You know, the reason that we haven't done it is that I'm a wimp. You know, if we did drill a 10th hole and it was blind, you know, it would be difficult to explain that to shareholders. But I think that we probably will go back to Crunchy and drill a hole or two there at some stage in the future, because I'm quite excited about Crunchy. I think that there's something there. However, I don't want to get blinkered, and I do want to see what's at Yowie and these other targets. And again, apologies when I was ranting just now, that was nothing to do with you. I was glad that you asked the question.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited about the target that we press released this morning, which is Appia, which looks like it's got a silica terrace, a sinter on the top, and it has vuggy silica. And I'd love to get a hole into that, and we will down the road. Of course, you know, this is brand new.
And Yowie, just to remind everyone, Yowie has exactly the same characteristics. It has the silicate, the sinter terrace, which is where the old geysers were.
That's right. So anyway, regarding LIDAR, we're going to do it. We've already contracted a company. And we paid a deposit, so it's going to happen. It's going to take a while to get the equipment into country and then to get a permit from the military, which is what we have to, well, what they have to do as contractors. But it is in the plan, and it will be carried out.
And, you know, so, James, when I referred to Metron a little bit earlier and possibly adding additional data layers to that study, you know, you hit the nail on the head. LIDAR is going to be a layer that will be added to the Metron data set shortly. And the other thing that I should just mention about LIDAR is that not only should it identify any activity at Logroño and Sevilla, and let's just remember that, you know, when we talk about cities, they were wooden palisade forts. They would have rotted. There would be absolutely nothing left of them. And you said absolutely rightly that the LIDAR will probably pick up the dumps and things. You're spot on. Mm-hmm. That's what we'll be looking for in the LIDAR and old roads. We expect that to come through on the LIDAR data. But the other component of the LIDAR is that it will undoubtedly help us in the targeting of the epithermal gold, silver, and also these flat sheets of the copper, silver. The LIDAR will give us enough of a sort of X-ray of the structure of the rock layers that not only will it help us on the historical side for those targets of Logroño and Sevilla, but it will also help us with our more precise targeting of the other mineralization types, and that will also feed into the Metron data.
Well, it's all very exciting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There are no more questions at this time. This concludes the question and answer session. I would now like to turn the conference back over to Dr. Keith Barron and Dr. Richard Spencer for any closing remarks.
Well, this is Keith here. I'm really, really excited about the future. You know, in my 36 years of activity working around the world on various ore deposits and exploration, I've never seen anything like this, this abundance of targets and this variety of targets. And never mind, you know, the original premise that we started with to find Logroño and Sevilla de Oro. I mean, they're just icing on the cake, and I am convinced that we will find them. It's onwards and upwards. I'm extremely pleased with the activity to the south, with the joint ventures that are happening in Ecuador. It really looks like Ecuador is coming on strong as a powerhouse of activity, and also as probably one of the last and best frontier areas left in the whole world. So it's onward and upward, folks, and I thank you, all of our shareholders, for participating along with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for your support. We absolutely couldn't do it without you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating and have a pleasant day.